Support for WPR comes from Luther College in Decorah, Iowa, a community where students are invited to learn actively, lead courageously, and live purposefully for a lifetime of impact. More about Luther College at luther.edu.
Support for WPR comes from the Dram Corporation, based in Manitowoc, Wisconsin. Manufacturers of professional-grade handheld watering nozzles, sprinklers, and cutting tools. More information is at dramm.com.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk to a fitness writer about new research showing a link between exercise and increased creativity.
First, we're talking about a new report from the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance that says Wisconsin is about to undergo a huge demographic shift that will affect employers, taxpayers, government, and the ability of the state's economy to grow over the next 30 years.
Todd Berry is with us to discuss the new report. He's president of the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance. Todd, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me back.
So what is this big demographic shift we're looking at over the next quarter century or so?
Well, this is not mysterious or anything. We have a lot of baby boomers who are maturing and getting ready to leave the workforce, and anybody that's been watching school enrollments for the last decade or two knows that the number of young people has been declining in the state, and when you put those two together, what you end up with is a state workforce that is not going to grow at all over the next 20 to 30 years.
So we're aging, fewer people in the labor market. What might that do to our economy?
Yeah. Well, you know, there's been a lot of back and forth between partisans over job creation and economic growth, but really fundamentally, if you don't have more people, you can't create jobs because you don't have any people to put in those jobs.
And it seems like that might be a good news scenario for younger people. There are fewer of them to go around for
sure.
The existing pool of jobs. So maybe unemployment would go down in that scenario?
Yeah, you'd expect that the wages would be bid up, that unemployment would be low. It certainly would be, Wisconsin would be an attractive place for people to come to in terms of employment. But again, there's a little bit of a chicken and egg problem because if you don't have the people, then you can't have the jobs.
Right. So an employer might say, I need to start a new factory. There are no workers in Wisconsin. I'm going to go elsewhere. I'm not going to go to Wisconsin.
Yeah,
to do this.
That's certainly one possibility. Or, you know, they maintain their operations here and decide they need a second plant or whatever somewhere else.
And is this uniform across the state or affecting more areas than others?
Mm-hmm. Well, it is differential in its impact, but in some ways, it's surprising at how widespread it is. There are only going to be, I think, in the next 30 years, about 21 counties out of 72 where the labor force is going to grow, and only four where it's going to grow 10% or more. In other words, the vast majority of Wisconsin counties are going to see their workforce size be static, and in a fair number of them, the decline is going to be 10% or more. If you look across a great part of northern Wisconsin, part of that Central Sands area, part of the Southwest, those are the areas where the labor force is expected to shrink the most. And that's not surprising in a sense because that's where we've seen school enrollments falling for a decade or two.
What does this mean for state government? I mean, in part, they'll also have a smaller pool for labor. Mm-hmm. But what about revenue if we see this declining pool of workers?
Well, you know, one thing about the baby boomers, when they were born and grew up and so forth, there were houses built and cars purchased and appliances bought and children clothed and school enrollments growing. And it really was very much an engine for economic growth. And if you have a workforce that's static, you're not going to see as rapid total income growth. There are not going to be as many new households forming where they buy a lot of these big durable goods that that generate sales tax revenue. So I don't think you're going to foresee going into the future the kind of robust state tax growth that you saw, say, in the 90s when we were growing 6, 7, 8, 9% per year.
As you say, this isn't a secret or a mystery. We know it's coming. We see it off in the distance. Knowing that, is there anything we can do about it?
Yeah. Well, we put out a report 10 years ago titled Wisconsin 2015, where we outlined this issue. So,
and we fixed it between now then and now.
Yeah, we sort of missed an opportunity there, but there are certainly things you can do. First of all, you've got to make sure that you graduate and educate well every possible young person from high school. We just can't afford to have higher dropout rates in some districts. It certainly is an opportunity to continue to tap in flexible ways the expertise of retiring baby boomers. It also offers an opportunity to try to lure back to Wisconsin natives who perhaps wanted to stay here, but because of their college educations in business, finance, information technology, or whatever, there simply weren't enough openings for them. And so that would be another source. We're going to have to talk about in-migration, and that means immigration, too. If we didn't have to worry about the federal government, I would say that state political and business leaders should be waving a magic wand and starting to look at other countries that have well-educated, high-trained labor forces that we could go after, in a sense.
So chasing after not just within the country, but international immigration to Wisconsin.
Yeah. I mean, we've known for some time that certain sectors of the U.S. economy wish they could import more people of high skill and high education levels.
One sidebar to this, you mentioned school districts earlier. We already see this problem in counties with declining populations, mm-hmm. Districts with fixed costs, the size of their school buildings and that sort of thing, but declining enrollments and thus declining state funding. Do you see this as a growing problem in the future as well?
Well, we already have that problem. We've had it for since the late 90s, and because the state limits revenue growth in part based on enrollment, we've had smaller, isolated school districts under the squeeze in terms of revenue for some time. So for them, it's just going to be a continuation of what we've already known.
So you did this report 10 years ago. You're doing it again today. Do you think lawmakers are taking this issue seriously? Are they looking that far into the future and trying to come up with a formula to fix that now?
Well, whenever I talk to people that work in the Capitol, lawmakers, lobbyists, whatever, one of the first things out of their mouths is always, this in a full-time professional legislature, the time horizon is very short. It's the next election, and so they really don't have. Even if they have the will, they don't have the capacity to think long-term and strategically. So it is a challenge, but it's one that is so pervasive, it doesn't touch one party or one region. It should be something that collectively state leaders can work together on.
Well, maybe we'll check in with you in the future to see if they're doing that. Todd, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
That's Todd Berry. He's president of the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance, talking about a new report showing how Wisconsin's aging population could hurt the state's economy.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. At this point, we all know that exercise is good for our bodies, especially good for our brains. But here's something I didn't necessarily know. A short walk around our office could help boost our creativity.
Gretchen Reynolds is here to break down some new research proving that exercise can increase our creativity. Gretchen is the phys ed columnist for the New York Times Well blog. Gretchen, good to have you back.
Thanks so much for having me.
So like I said, you know, we've heard that exercise is not only good for our bodies, that it does good things for our brains too, but creativity is a new angle on all of this. What do we know about how exercise can improve creativity?
Well, you're right. There have been a lot of studies that have looked at the link between exercise and various kinds of thinking and have shown pretty persuasively that exercise can improve memory and other types of thinking. But until this new study came out, no one had really specifically looked at whether exercise could affect creativity. And so researchers at Stanford developed a really interesting way of examining this question. They gathered a bunch of college students, because they're readily available on the Stanford campus, and they brought them into a very boring room, and they deliberately made it boring so that there wouldn't be anything stimulating in the room itself. And then they had the students first sit at a desk and perform a series of tests that are designed to study creativity. And one of them, which I thought was pretty interesting, is they had to very quickly come up with new uses for a very common object. And in one case, it was a button. So they had to just sort of throw out any ideas they could come up with about how to use a button. And then the scientists had them perform the same test with a different object while they were walking on a treadmill, also in this office. And they were just staring at the wall ahead of them and walking on a treadmill and throwing out ideas for how to use a button or whatever the object was. And it turned out that just by walking, they were about 60% more creative. They came up with a lot more and much better ideas when they were walking than when they were sitting.
60% is a lot more creative. I mean, it's not even just a little bit more creative. What's going on there?
Well, the first thing is the study then went on, and this was important because it wasn't clear whether you would be more creative only while people were walking, which would mean that we would all have to have, you know, treadmills in our offices or, you know, perform walking meetings. So they next had the kids, a different set of students, either sat and did the test and then sat and did it again, or and then sat, and they were still very creative when they sat after walking. They were still about 60% more creative. So the results definitely lingered. And they also lingered, which was, again, quite interesting, even when the people did not go outside to walk, which a lot of us would probably think that we'd be far more creative, just think better, if we went outside for a walk than if we stayed in our office and stared at a blank wall. But that wasn't true. They actually were just as creative if they walked on a treadmill in an office as if they went outside and walked around the beautiful Stanford campus.
Well, so it's really just the movement itself. It's not really fresh air, sunshine, you know, endorphins of being outside, nothing like that. It's just moving.
It appears to be the walking. And they weren't just walking. They were walking at whatever pace they felt like going. It wasn't jogging. It wasn't anything strenuous. It was just a very, essentially, easy stroll that people did for about, the test tended to run for about 8 minutes, so it wasn't lengthy. And as a result of that really small amount of activity, they increased their ability to come up with creative ideas just enormously.
So what do we know about why that happened? Does it have something to do with increased blood flow and maybe oxygenation to the brain?
Possibly. That's a good creative idea.
And I'm sitting down.
Well, this study was not a formal neurological study, although the authors do hope to do one in which they will have people wear, you know, functional MRI caps and try to see what's happening in their brains. They didn't do that this time, so it's just speculation. But the authors think it may have something to do with blood flow. It may have something to do with raising people's moods, that it's almost a side benefit of people feeling happier when they're walking, and that's somehow changing their ability to think creatively. it may be that there's something about the physical movement itself that sparks activity in certain parts of the brain that are related to activity. That will be studied next, but the almost immediate takeaway is if you need to come up with good ideas, go for a walk.
Well, it's a fantastic idea, but most workplaces aren't geared toward walking. If I started walking around our little square of an office space up here, people, I think, would think that was really bizarre. It's hard to get outside at all. I mean, do you think this is going to change workplace culture?
As a matter of fact, yes. It certainly has. This whole idea has been sort of percolating in a number of businesses, particularly in places like, say, California, for a while. And the whole idea of walking meetings has become very trendy. And people do, in fact, at a number of large corporations, they do make an effort to get people moving during the workday. But most of the support for that has been purely anecdotal. People would say, I think I actually, think better and come up with better ideas after I walk. But their bosses would say, hey, that you're procrastinating. Now, there really is scientific backing for the idea that people will be more productive. They will think better. They will come up with more creative ways to work if you allow them to get up and move. And it doesn't require a lot of equipment. You don't have to have treadmills in people's offices. Let them get up and stroll down the hallway. This study would suggest that any amount of movement is likely to spark creative thinking. And that's really, I find it wonderful to think about that.
It is a really interesting thought. We tried this out a little here on the Central Time team last summer on, like a 99-degree day. We went for a walking meeting, and almost half of us thought we were going to die during the walk. So I don't know if it was a success for our particular team, but that could speak more to the Wisconsin summer than anything else. I wonder if you think that, people who work in offices should petition and say, look, we are going to be more creative. We need to get outside.
I would say yes, and you can expand from that to you don't have to get outside if the weather is miserable, if it's raining, if the humidity is 120%. This study suggests that you don't need a landscape, you don't need nice weather. All you need is the movement. You need to stand up. And yes, I would much rather go outside and go for a walk than stare at the wall in my office. But if your goal is simply to start thinking better, it appears all you need to do is stand up and move. And you don't have to go outside. You don't need the sun. You just need to have your body moving.
What do you make of the fact that it was just this really mild strolling that correlated with a 60% jump in creativity? Because it seems like lately when we hear about exercise science, you really have to go gonzo, all out, high intensity interval training to get any kind of, real payoff. Why is it such a mild form of exercise? I mean, do you think that if we're running ultra marathons, we'll be even more creative?
Probably not, actually. I mean, there is some evidence that people think less well after strenuous exercise, and that's because simply their bodies are fatigued, and that is reflected in the ability to think. To me, this study makes perfect sense in terms of what we know about human evolution, because in terms of our, far-off ancestors, if they sat around and didn't pay attention to things, they became someone's lunch. If they got up and just moved around a little bit, paid attention to what was going on around them, came up with creative ways to get away from whatever was chasing them, they survived and passed along their genetics. That was not running marathons. That was getting up, moving, going for a walk. It would make perfect sense that that amount of exercise, which is really quite slight, can affect how well you think, how well you come up with creative ways to solve a problem. Whereas running a marathon is not going to have the same benefit because it does make you physically and mentally tired.
And Gretchen, our last 30 seconds here. Last week we had a guest on who said that sitting is the new smoking. So this exercise, creativity link, is this just going to add more, you know, weight to that argument that it's time to stop sitting so much and get moving?
Yes, I think there's no doubt about it. I think it does very much add to a growing body of evidence that we are not meant to sit. That if nothing else, if you can't manage to go for an 8-minute walk, at least stand up and stroll around your office every 20 minutes or so. It will improve your health. And this new study seems to suggest very strongly that it will make you more creative and a better employee.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Gretchen, we're out of time. Thank you so much for sharing this with us.
Sure, it was my pleasure.
That was Gretchen Reynolds. She writes the Well blog at the New York Times. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time. Stay tuned. There's more to come.
It's been 10 years since Americans were first exposed to photos taken at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq, photos that depicted the degradation, abuse, and even torture of prisoners at the hands of American military personnel. For many Americans, it was a wake-up call, and our next guest says it began America's public odyssey with torture.
But 10 years later, how have we addressed the legacy of what happened at Abu Ghraib? And as the Senate and CIA tangle over the release of a report that details the country's interrogation program in the last decade, what else will come to light? And will any of it matter to the public and to politics? Joining us now is Karen Greenberg, director of the Center on National Security at the Fordham Law School. Karen, welcome to Central Time.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's go back 10 years to the release of those photographs on 60 Minutes 2. How did they first break?
Well, as you said, they first broke on 60 Minutes 2. There were six of them. They were really the only six pictures that the wider American public saw for quite a while, and they showed shocking images. I don't know if you remember, but of people being put in humiliating positions, people being, you know, naked, forced to stand in pyramids of naked people, people being threatened with dogs, some people bleeding. But it turned out to be the tip of the iceberg.
How did Americans react at the time?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, I think a lot of Americans were horrified. I think there was a sense built largely by the administration, but also by what the wider public wanted to think, that this was just an unheard of example, a unique time and place, that there had been lower level soldiers who had acted out for a variety of reasons in this prison in Iraq. But what it turned out to be was a window onto a much broader policy of abuse and torture that was widespread outside of the military, actually, and that had trickled down in its own way into the atmosphere that was encouraged in the prison in Iraq.
How soon after those photos were released did we start to see the development of that dichotomy that was sort of posed mostly by the government, that enhanced interrogation or torture was necessary to safeguard Americans in the wake of 9/11?
You know, actually, it was a while before that narrative became very strong, because for a long time, the administration backed away from having to talk about what these policies were. Even when the memos on torture were leaked later in 2004, there wasn't really a sense of the government embracing this policy. The first time it came out in the direct way that we live with today was in 2006 in September, 5 days before the fifth anniversary of 9/11, when President Bush addressed the media and said, yes, in fact, we have had this program. And he was referring to the wider interrogation program at the CIA black sites that hadn't been really acknowledged before. Yes, we had this program, and yes, it worked. And here are some examples of how it worked, and this has been very important to our national security. Once he did that, and the cat was out of the bag in terms of truly knowing about the program and embracing the program, it became a very strong narrative among those who either had participated in it or those who had been convinced for one reason or another to believe in it.
And to be clear, when these photos come out, torture is illegal in the United States, right?
Well, it depends on, yes, torture is illegal in the United States. It has always been illegal in the United States. But when these photos came out, unbeknownst to the American public, secret memos had been written inside the Department of Justice 2 years prior to that, in the summer of 2002, basically saying that, redefining torture and saying that torture had to do with organ failure and death, and was not definable in ways that were popularly understood as and culturally and historically understood as torture. And so even to this day, you'll have people who say, yeah, we did that, but it had been legally authorized by these memos. And that's something that's still debated to this day.
Well, the memos is the beginning of the narrative of what happened behind the scenes and how it had been authorized, these interrogation techniques. In the meantime, let's talk about some of what those memos revealed and the voices behind different points of view. What did the memos say?
The memos started with the premise that had been present in many other memos from the Bush administration's Department of Justice, with the premise that 9/11 really was a game changer, and that the United States needed to rethink its legal authorities and the parameters of what it was willing to do in order to make itself safe. And central to keeping America safe was the intelligence game and knowing who your enemy was, what they were planning, and what they were doing. And so the memos very much spoke to this point, that the purpose of this was not punishment of the enemy. The purpose of this was to elicit actionable intelligence from individuals who knew about al-Qaeda, who knew about bin Laden, and could talk about follow-on attacks or other attacks that would occur down the line, categories of attacks, whether it was types of suicide bombings or whatever else it was. So that was what the memos addressed. And then in graphic detail, these memos and subsequent memos talked about what could be allowed and what couldn't be allowed. And what had essentially happened was that the lawyers at the Central Intelligence Agency had asked the Department of Justice for four memos or a memo that would clarify a series of techniques. What could be done? Was slapping allowed? Was hooding allowed? Was stress positions where you get tied up, let's say, with your hands behind your back allowed? Was nudity allowed? It just went on down the line of was isolation allowed? Was sleep deprivation allowed? And then ultimately, of course, was waterboarding allowed? And so that specific ways, as well as in general ways, the intelligence agency asked the Department of Justice for authorization on each one of these techniques. And over time, these are the techniques that were used. And not all the techniques that were asked for, and certainly one in particular, were allowed, but waterboarding was allowed. And I think that probably was maybe even a surprise to the intelligence agency.
And was the word torture ever used, or was this just all flying under the banner of enhanced interrogation techniques?
You know, it's funny. The word torture is something that's very hotly debated now, and I know that a lot of media doesn't like it to be used. Over time, these became known as enhanced interrogation techniques, and that's how the people who devised the policy like to refer to it. But nevertheless, they were referring to laws that were on the books that had to do with torture, that had to do with abuse, that had, you know, the United States had signed on to the Convention Against Torture, and things like that. So torture is very much in the background, if not in the foreground. But today, when it comes up, as it was then, it is a legal term. And the question was, the reason they don't want to use the word torture is because if it's torture, it's illegal. Therefore, it can't be torture, if that makes sense to you.
Because it's covered, prisoners are afforded rights under the Geneva Convention.
Right, and under domestic law, and under the Uniform Court of Military Justice. So any one of the legal regimes that you want to point to, whether it's domestic, international, or military, prohibited torture.
What did we hear from dissenting voices, or what do we know now about some of the debate that must have gone on you would think behind the scenes, for instance, you know, John McCain, who was himself tortured, and people of similar of thought, what do we know about those voices who might have said, you know, hang on a minute, let's think about this a little more closely?
Yeah, well, we know a couple of things. We know that whoever was dissenting, they did not make their voice loud enough. And they were not able or willing to provide enough leadership to get a real national movement working inside government that would be opposed to torture. John McCain, who himself, as you say, was tortured, has been a staunch opponent of torture and sponsored the bill on detainee treatment in 2005, and yet backed away from accountability for those who had devised or committed the torture. Nobody's documented precisely who knew what when, but there were clearly suspicions everywhere that extraordinary and abusive measures were being taken. And one of the ways, you know, are in some of the memos that are written back and forth inside the government about whether or not the Geneva Conventions apply to these detainees in U.S. custody. And there is a suspicion, and it's more than a suspicion. It's declared, let's say, in the memo written by Colin Powell, among others, that this is about interrogation. And we know this is about interrogation, and please be careful, Powell argues, in backing away from the Geneva Conventions, and please be careful in thinking that there won't be some kind of either reciprocity or call for accountability on these measures. So General Powell could have stood up and taken the lead on this as well. And there were lawyers inside the administration who had heard about it one way or another, maybe not in its full detail. I think people just wanted to believe it wouldn't happen, and probably in good faith couldn't believe it was actually happening, and so backed away from it. And in doing that, they left a wide open arena for this to go on out of sight, out of mind, and authorized secretly.
We're talking with Karen Greenberg right now about the 10th anniversary of the release of the Abu Ghraib photos, and we'd like to hear from you on this. What was your reaction when you first saw the photos? Did they affect your views on the use of enhanced interrogation techniques or make you think about torture? And do you think the country has a moral obligation to address torture that went on at Abu Ghraib and other parts of the world by the United States? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send an email to talk@WPR.org.
We'll pick up that conversation in just a moment after this look at the headlines with Noah Ovshinsky.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Karen Greenberg with the Fordham University Law School about the legacy left behind by the Abu Ghraib torture photos. They first came to light about 10 years ago.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Wondering about your initial reaction to those photos and what you think, if anything, has been decided in the country as we move past that era. Where do you think we stand now on torture, and where should we stand, and what is the moral obligation going forward? 800-642-1234. We'll go to the phones now and take Victor first in Milwaukee. Hi, Victor.
Hello, good afternoon. When I first saw the photos, they were awful, but I'm not surprised. You know, war is dirty, and they say war is hell. You know, one can be naive about it, and one can be expectant about it, so none of it surprised me. My big concern is that I'm in Iron Forces myself. You know, when one of us becomes a POW, we cannot expect our enemy to treat us with any civility, any of that, because they're going to refer back to Abu Ghraib and those photos and our abuses, regardless of how we want to legitimize it. They're going to see that. So it puts American armed forces in trouble if we become POWs. So that's the legacy that has.
And Victor, is that something that you heard other service people worried about, that maybe now sort of the floodgates were opening?
Some would support it, you know, because, of course, if you're on the victorious side, you know, a lot of things are legitimate. Others say no, they're concerned about it. So I got mixed views about it. Personally, I was totally against it because, again, I'm concerned about the danger it puts us in. So, again, we don't have a moral leg to stand on. We go around the world globally trying to uphold the Geneva Conference and everything, and we're going to look like hypocrites because of what happened at Abu Ghraib.
All right. Thank you so much for your thoughts, Victor. Appreciate that. And Karen, what do you make of those comments that going forward, you know, how do we look, first of all, and what are the repercussions for American soldiers and military personnel?
You know, I think it's a really good point. I think it's something that the generals inside the military were aware of very early on after Abu Ghraib and were worried about. And it's one of the reasons that the military actually took the time and trouble to do numerous reports on Abu Ghraib and on prisoner treatment throughout the conflict zones, because they were worried, among other things, about potential reciprocity. They're also worried about just breaking the law and about the backlash that could occur generally. But the military doctrine, which is that of reciprocity, what you do can also happen to you. If it's a lawless zone out there, it's a lawless zone that affects all of us, was very much a preoccupation of those who were concerned with this early on. Not enough of a preoccupation to force a change in policy, particularly when it was outside the military and in these intelligence sites. And once it became totally separated from the military in that way, maybe it was a different story.
All right. Well, let's go back to the phones, and thank you to Victor for that call. And next is Daniel in Milwaukee. Hi, Daniel.
Hey, how you doing, ma'am?
Okay. What do you think about this?
Well, I was actually in the Army interrogator school during the when Abu G broke. And so what I watched happening was, obviously, if you read into the nuts and bolts of it, it wasn't Army interrogators conducting, you know, these enhanced techniques and humiliation exercises. Contract security guards, and I believe a couple of military police officers. However, the military interrogation community really suffered the most significant blow, I think, even more than the Central Intelligence Agency did. We had our interrogation handbook that we were learning off of and practicing was removed, rewritten, and then republished as an unclassified document to try to facilitate openness and prevent backlash. But moreover, it really put a fear into the hearts of commanders deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan to use interrogators in their best potential, which is honestly conducting questioning at the site of an attack, just the same way police officers and try to, you know, question witnesses at the scene of a crime or an incident. The best information comes from people who are excited or upset or scared. And in my decade of experience, no enhanced interrogation techniques have ever been necessary. I'm significantly against torture, not because of the Geneva Conventions, because honestly, the Geneva Conventions is supposed to apply to uniformed military conflicts, and our enemies for the last decade haven't worn uniforms, but more the fact that we represent the first world, and we need to continue to represent the first world in a higher, a higher purpose for humanity, even when engaging in warfare in the third world.
All right, Daniel, thank you so much. That's an interesting perspective from someone who was in the Army interrogation school. Karen, what do you think about Daniel's insights there?
I think they're really worse than thought, and very interesting. I think that line between what the military was tasked with doing, what the Central Intelligence Agency and contractors were doing, and who suffered for it, whose policies were actually changed, is interesting. And what he says has a ring of truth to it, which is that the military bore the brunt of the change of policy, whereas for the other interrogations, it was a matter of time before the president and the executive decided they wanted to stop doing those things. And to, you know, if you think about it, they could actually be revived. There hasn't been any accountability. There hasn't been a general sense of this will never happen again. Because there hasn't been accountability, there has been accountability inside the military. As you know, some of the people at Abu Ghraib were punished and put in jail for what they did. The people who devised the policy, the people who belonged to the executive, the people who are outside the military, were not punished. And so I think he's saying two things. One is that the military was punished, but he's also saying that the military is somewhat curtailed, as I heard it, somewhat curtailed in what it would like to do even legally because how it was held accountable, even in its own mind, held accountable for things that were still being done elsewhere. So I think that's a very interesting comment.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Daniel, for the call. And moving forward a bit in time, President Obama has shut down Abu Ghraib and not really taken a solid stance on the issue of intense interrogation or torture, said we're looking forward, we're not looking backward. How would you characterize the way that his administration has addressed it?
I think they have taken a solid stand on it. I think from day one, the president said, we are not a country that tortures, and we're going to go about these kinds of interrogations and detentions legally when it comes to the interviews and how we collect the information. That's what he said. But part and parcel of that, and it looks like this is true more and more over time, part and parcel of that is holding accountable the people who devise these policies. Because if it's just all the same, whether they the country in its name conducted enhanced interrogations and torture, then why wouldn't it be done again? And what kind of trouble does that get us into as a people, as a country with a reputation in the world, that it, as your first caller said, that it has previously stood for? What is all that going to mean? And so the president stopped it at, we disagree with this administration. We're not going to do this. This is not who we are as a country. But I really do wonder, and I think many wonder, if that was enough in terms of preventing it going forward in other dark times.
And now we're waiting to see if it's going to be released, a giant report detailing some of the details of the country's involvement in torture over the past decade. What do you expect from that?
Oh, that's such a good question. I mean, the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence is under Dianne Feinstein is going to release this massive report. We're going to the public should get to see the executive summary, I'm sure redacted, and the conclusion once the CIA and the White House have vetted those pieces of the report. I don't know what we're going to get out of it, but I do suspect, given all the controversy and the things that have been leaked to the press, that what is going to happen is that some of the narrative in terms of how this worked and what was done, both those things, is different than what the public has actually understood on the record has been the case. And so there may have been techniques used or combinations of techniques used that actually weren't authorized legally. There may be, and that could have consequences going into the future. And I think also the question, not one that I like thinking about, but the question of did it work or didn't it work, there's always been a he said, she said about it. I think this report may, and I'm not sure we'll see this report or the report or know it, but it's possible, may cast a good deal of doubt on just what these interrogations ever got the country in terms of national security, that information that was not already in hand one way or another, or information that, like the interrogation and torture of Al-Libi, led to wrong information in that case.
And I'm sorry, we have to leave it there, Karen. We're out of time.
Sorry.
But thank you so much for joining us.
Okay.
It was a pleasure to talk to you. Talking to Karen Greenberg, Director of the Center on National Security at the Fordham Law School.
Stick around, more to come. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio.